Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and wherever you are in the world, well, it's great to have you with us. Today, I'm joined by two fabulous writers who'll be going head-to-head in a war of the words a little later on. My first guest is a writer, journalist who was born in Copenhagen, but has lived in London for many years, a graduate of the MA in Creative Writing at Birkbeck. She was previously shortlisted for the V.S. Pritchett Memorial Prize. Her debut novel, My Name is Jensen, was published in 2021. And here to tell us about her second novel, The Girl in the Photo, it's Heidi Amsink. Hello.
Hello.
It's lovely to see you have you here in the studio.
Thank you.
I've realised very rudely, as I sit here sipping coffee, I didn't offer you one. So we've got off to a great start.
British hospitality.
And my second guest is one half of the Ambrose Parry writing team. She's a consultant anaesthetist with 20 years' experience, whose research for her master's in the history of medicine uncovered the material upon which their novels are based. Ambrose Parry is a pseudonym for a collaboration between Chris Brookmeyer and Marissa Heitzman. One of them has been on Book Off before, and now it's time for the other to step up. Hello, Marissa.
Hello.
And greetings from Scotland. You are virtual today. We're waving at you through the ether.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I could offer you a coffee as well, but it's going to be cold by the time it arrives. So, now, Heidi, I know that you have met Chris, but I don't know if you've met Marissa, have you?
So I've never met Marissa.
Here are the official introductions. No. Heidi, Marissa, Marissa, Heidi.
Except I've been in Edinburgh in my head in the last few days, so I've been reading Ambrose Parry and really, really enjoyed it. So I feel I can, I've heard Marissa's voice.
Yes. Exactly. Well, we're going to talk about both of your brilliant new books. We're going to talk about your writing, and we're going to get some book recommendations from you both as well. Heidi, let's talk about The Girl in the Photo first, though, if I may. And as I said, this is the second Jensen thriller, right?
Yeah.
There'll be some people listening who've read your previous book, might even have got to this one so far. But could you just introduce us to this character for anyone who hasn't yet?
Yeah, so Jensen is a reporter, a bit like me, but she returns to Denmark, which I never did. And she can't really find her feet back in Copenhagen. She doesn't really recognise the city. It feels a bit familiar, but things have changed since she's been away. So that's clearly a device that allows me to travel through the city of my birth and tell you about it as if it's new, even though she is Danish and she was born in Copenhagen. So because I think primarily this was my kind of lockdown love letter to Copenhagen, where I was born and spent my childhood years. And Jensen is a reporter, as I said, who returns home and literally stumbles across a body in her first book. She then calls the only person she can think of, her former lover in the police, Henrik Jungersen, who is a DI, and because he kind of owes her. And she thinks she can get the inside track if she connects with him. She's also got a teenage apprentice at the newspaper, which is called Dagbladet, which is in City Hall Square, in the same location as a well-known Danish newspaper. And Gustav is even more kind of anarchist than Jensen. So if Henrik is procedure, police, rules, regulations, Jensen does what she wants, and Gustav is just complete anarchy. He's a teenage boy and he can kind of, you know, make himself invisible because teenage boys kind of are. People are either scared of them or kind of completely disregard them.
That's so true.
I've had a few teenage boys in my house. So it was loosely inspired by my son who spent lockdown with me. So, and he read chapter after chapter as I wrote the first book. So in The Girl in the Photo, Jensen has been through one case. She's come together with Henrik and they've parted again. He is in a dreadful state. He's been thrown out of home. And so he's got one thought in his head is to avoid Jensen because the two of them just can't keep their hands off each other. And but that doesn't work because she becomes involved in a case that he is investigating. And soon they're back together. And they kind of discover the thing that's the device behind these books, which is that you can't do it on your own. You have to combine, you have to be diverse in your thinking. You have to, combine your methods in order to reach the conclusion. So really, they can't solve these murders without each other which is sort of the tension in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's your relationship like to Copenhagen? Like how do you love it still, even though you don't live there? Yeah.
Yeah. So I emigrated quite happily to the UK when I was in my early 20s. And I love this country and I'm a citizen here now. I'm very proud of that.
Welcome.
I love the... Thank you very much. I passed the test.
I wouldn't.
No, I think you wouldn't. Actually, there's a book that you have to read. Otherwise, you have no chance.
No.
It's things like what do you have to put on a dog tag in the UK and things like that that you have to know for this test. But I love Copenhagen. Copenhagen to me is kind of half remembered, half imagined. You know, it's where I don't know if it's true, but your imagination seems to sort of somehow lock in some early years where it's particularly vibrant, you know, and you absorb stories more perhaps for a few years in your kind of early youth. And I think that was the time I spent in Copenhagen and I was reading, you know, the Brothers Grimm. I love fairy tales, anything dark, anything grim. And I think the two just meshed. And now for me, Copenhagen is a place of shadows, darkness, wood panelled rooms. Rooms, kind of dingy canals. And so I can't quite match the atmosphere of Edinburgh. I wish I could because I love Edinburgh. I love walking around and also in books. But for me, it's that kind of, dark place, even though for other people, I think it's a place of hygge and fun and light and happy people.
For me, it's the only time I ever went to Copenhagen was on a New Year's Eve. And for me, all I'll remember is people setting off fireworks in the square.
Yes.
Just sort of there and like, right next to you.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I ran for my life.
Yeah, that's what we do on New Year's Eve. Dangerous place.
It was a dangerous place, but it was fun.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to Copenhagen, Marissa?
No, but I did read My Name is Jensen and it really made me want to go, which is a bit strange because there's a lot of really unpleasant things going on in the book. Yeah. But I really did want to visit.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah, I'm paid by the Copenhagen Tourist Board. No, but I actually, I'm really glad to hear you say that because I really want to send people there. I want people to see, you know, my city is really beautiful. It's very small, you know, 1.something million people. You can walk from one end to the other.
Gorgeous harbour, as I remember.
Gorgeous harbour.
Yeah,
so I include a map with the books so that you can, trace your route and follow around and, might even sell a tour in future.
Yes,
I'm laying down an investment.
Marissa, let's talk about Voices of the Dead because this is your latest one. And I know is this the fourth Ambrose Parry book?
Yes, it is.
Goodness me. Where's that?
She had to think there for a minute.
I know. Well, I did as well. I mean, where's the time gone? Blimey. Could you perhaps introduce us first to Dr. Will Raven, just for those who may not have come to any of your books yet?
Yeah. Well, Will Raven starts off in the first book in the series as the apprentice to the very renowned James Young Simpson, the discoverer of chloroform. And he becomes involved in various... he ends up getting embroiled in various crimes, not willingly most of the time. He very much wants to emulate his mentor and he doesn't usually quite come up to scratch a lot of the time. And his kind of friend, on and off friendship really is Sarah Fisher, who was in the first book Simpson's housemaid, but she has aspirations to better herself. And the two of them are often involved together. As Heidi was saying, often you need more than one person to kind of get to the bottom of something. So Sarah is often, and I like to play with the fact that although Raven has a medical education, Sarah is sometimes the smarter of the two. so they kind of team up to kind of solve various mysteries. And there's usually a lot of... It's often medically related stuff because that's where my interest lies. And in Voices of the Dead, Raven is called upon to investigate as discreetly as possible the fact that some body parts have been found in Surgeon's Hall and they're not dissection specimens. And the spectre of Burke and Hare and grave robbing kind of hangs over Edinburgh even after all this time. And they're very keen that there's no scandal. But unfortunately, more body parts are discovered in different parts of the city, and Raven has to, it gets a bit more murky, and the prime suspect is an actor who is known as a master of disguise. So it all gets very complicated, and of course, Sarah has to get involved to help out. And he was supposed to be discreet, but the press get wind of it and it turns into a massive hysterical, there's a serial killer on the loose sort of thing. So it was actually quite fun to write because some of the previous books have dealt with some really, really dark stuff. Yeah. So this is about, there's a lot of stuff about spiritualism and mesmerism and the kind of murky borderlands between science and progress and quackery. So it was actually a lot of fun to write.
Quackery. That's great. Yeah, I don't know if I've used that heard or used that term before. I love that. Bit of quackery. Yeah. Do you like writing, you know, in the 19th century?
I really enjoy it actually. I think because I read a lot about 19th century medicine, that's kind of my main focus of fascination. And what really intrigues me is the things that are really familiar, things that you're like, oh, we still behave that way now, or we still do things that way now, and the things that are so different. And it's just endlessly fascinating how much progress we've made in some aspects of life and how little in others.
Yeah, yeah. I remember talking to an author on Book Off in a previous series who'd written in, I think, 18th century, perhaps, they were writing some historical crime. And they said it was amazing to go to all the places. It was set in London specifically, so they were in London going to all these streets that still existed, most of them, and actually looking up and going, right, well, actually, this is all different down here, shop fronts, etc. But looking up at the roofs, she was like, but that is how it would have been in the novel that I'm writing. And there's that, it's so fascinating, isn't it, to be like, oh, there's that hasn't changed, you know, that's still there, holding on, all of that history.
Yeah, yeah.
Heidi, I'm fascinated by Scandi crime. And the reason I'm fascinated is because there was this bubble of like, oh, the killing, everyone's watching it, Saalund. And then there was The Bridge. And then there's other TV shows. And then there's Scandi Noir now, the festival that happens in Iceland. And then there's just this amazing selection of Scandi crime books now and writers.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about that very specific genre that we Brits and readers from all over the world love so much?
I get asked this a lot, so I think about it a lot. I think that, one, there's darkness, so specifically sort of Icelandic crime. I envy them, the lava fields and the kind of winds and the weather and everything. Denmark is quite boring by comparison. So there's the darkness, the kind of long nights and all that, which sort of lends itself a little bit like Edinburgh's sort of... Because I was thinking of the street names, Canongate and all that. They're so evocative, you know, when you walk around... anyway, so I think the other thing is that it's a weird thing with crime fiction is that it's what we turn to when we want to relax, sit in front of the fire, you know, with a, and then you want to read about a serial killer. And I think that juxtaposition is also in Scandinavian crime fiction between It's kind of an exploding myth kind of thing. So you have these beautiful societies. I think we were for a number of years running the happiest nation in the world.
Yes.
And then you have this...
Norway took it from you for a bit as well, didn't they?
Bastards. And you know, we have everything sorted, welfare society, people eat at home at 6 o'clock with their children, they drive cargo bikes around the city with their kids and dogs, and it's absolutely wonderful. And then it's so enjoyable to sort of scratch the surface and then find something a little bit nasty underneath. And I think that tension between the so-called kind of happy societies, and I think there's a tradition in Nordic noir for using it as a vehicle to talk about the ills of you know, the world. And you see with Henning Mankell, he tackled many themes. He was very interested in immigration and the tensions that gave in you know, Swedish society. So, and even I was thinking the Valu and Sjöwall, you know, in the 60s writing the Martin Beck series, they also took up, and I think they started a, you know, tradition there for looking at topics. So in my first book, it's about kind of homelessness and displacement, and next book is about bullying and the effects of bullying and so on. I think there is a tradition for that, that people maybe, you know, maybe like. And then I think it's just a bit of sort of, it's a kind of literary version of porn, isn't it? Yeah. You sort of want to imagine yourself in a different place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's interesting you say that about the crime genre as well, because I'll always remember one of my first big long chats with the wonderful Mark Billingham. He said, you know, we as crime writers, he was sort of talking on behalf of everyone. He said, you know, it's our job to put a bit of, not for everyone, but he certainly wants to put contemporary issues into his book. So he wants to have his say through his fiction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that's really important.
Yeah.
I think that is absolutely right, that the crime genre, that huge umbrella that we call crime, is a really good place to do it.
Yeah.
I've got to ask, Marissa, and I know that you'll have been asked this a lot when you've done interviews, but I'm so fascinated because writing is, as we all know, quite a solitary affair. It's very much you are the boss when you're the author, and you get your first draft down, and you don't start having to answer questions or anything until your agent or editor has got it, right? But when you're working with not only another person, another writer, but your husband, I just think that must be such a amazing partnership, because not everyone could do that. So how does it work with you guys?
I think the reason that it works is that from the very beginning, we were bringing very different areas of expertise to the process. So we both acknowledged that we couldn't really do the Ambrose Parry thing, either of us alone. And obviously, Chris is a writer of more than 25 years experience, but
he's all right,
doesn't
yeah.
know.
He's all right.
He's, he's done. He's written a few good ones.
He's written a few books. So he's very experienced, and but he would admit that he doesn't know very much about, you know, 19th century medicine or crime or what the forensics were of the time and all that kind of thing. So we realised that we both brought different things to the process. So we kind of, it's been a learning experience, put it that way, because Chris is used to writing himself, so he's used to of working things out in his own head. And it took a long time for me to kind of get him to help, you know, plan things very explicitly so that I kind of understood where we were going. And so now we're far more organised that way now. Now that we've done book four, we're more organised. But I would never argue with him about aspects of plot or structure. And he doesn't argue with me about the historical detail. Mm. Although I have to kind of loosen up a little bit. I'm very kind of, I want to make it very authentic, but as Chris keeps reminding me, it is fiction. So you are allowed to kind of make bits up in between times. And so I've had to loosen up a bit, and he's had to get a bit more organised.
I love that. And it's worked beautifully.
Do you argue?
I wouldn't say we argue. I think it's usually things like he takes a flyer on something and then I read it afterwards. And there was something in the last book where the police surgeon, Chris decided, had a wooden leg, or he decided he had an artificial leg. But the version that Chris wrote, it was all some kind of metal alloy articulated steampunk thing. And I went into his office and I said, did you research this, you know, artificial limbs in the 19th century? And he just looked at me and went, no.
Of course I didn't.
So I had to kind of adjust it a wee bit. But yeah, it's just that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think it's great. Would you ever write with someone? Would you ever have that collaborative approach?
Especially not my my now ex-husband. I can't imagine that. No, I don't. No, but I'm very, I'm extrovert. So I have to, you know, I rely on other people. Mm. I play things off, and I have a kind of collaborator, a Danish police detective who helps me. And we spend a lot of time together. I sit with his team and they talk about their cases and what it feels like to be in the police. And I run things past them and they're very good at saying, this is not real, but you can put it in a book. It's okay. You can get away with it. Or saying, no, that would never
absolutely
happen.
Absolutely never happen.
Never happen in a million years. So I use that. And I, you know, I talk a lot to friends in Copenhagen about what life is like there, because obviously I haven't lived there for so many years. And I do, whilst I'm not trying to sort of make something social realistic, I, you know, I want it to feel real to Copenhageners who read the book.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I suppose, and correct me if I'm wrong, Marissa, but I imagine that you were and still are one of Chris's first readers, right? So when he was first started out on his writing career, you were reading his drafts, right? So has that that sort of set you up for this partnership anyway, in the sense that you've already been used to reading sort of his work and going back and forth and offering advice and stuff?
I think it certainly helped. Chris said that the reason he was quite happy to work with me was he felt I had good editorial judgment, because I often read his stuff. And there were there were times over the years where if you got stuck on a plot point, this is going back to the lack of planning. If you got stuck, we often would sit down and kind of thrash it out between us. Yeah. And I think that was in the early years. He didn't need me very much thereafter. But I think he probably trusted my judgment in a lot of ways, because I have always read his stuff and I'm very familiar with his style.
Exactly, of course, yeah. Mm. Well, Ambrose Parry really works. You've pulled it off. I can't believe it's book four. I really can't. I was like, God, I'm sure. I remember when this new author, he says, in quotes, was announced. And
Mr.
I was
Parry.
Like, oh, it's, yeah. I was like, oh, Mr. Parry. I wonder who is Mr. Parry coming to Harrogate, you know. And I discovered, you know, it was revealed the pseudonym is used. That felt, honestly, like it was 2 years ago. I can't believe that you're into book four. But anyway. I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently, because we love a book recommendation here on the podcast. Have you found time to read? Heidi, have you got anything that you want to shout about?
There's always a really tricky question, because I don't, at the moment, read enough, because I have a full-time job and I write
in
my spare time. Yeah, and I try and write a book a year in my spare time. So I use my holidays and weekends.
Right.
And I have, you know, I've just finished Jensen 3. I just can't read at the end of that. So now I'm in that kind of wonderful phase of, you know, reading. But I mean, reading Ambrose Parry and also because it's stuck with me for all the years is Louise Welsh's The Cutting Room, which has, you know, just some of that feel again of Ambrose Parry, where you kind of tumble down into this dark underworld and it's a kind of roller coaster ride and it never leaves that world. It's a very unique universe, very dark and very funny as well. I met Louise Welsh when I was writing my name is Miss Jensen, and she gave me some really good advice then, and was very kind to me when I kind of, you know, when it was published. So, but I think she is, you know, the queen of that kind of atmospheric city based kind of, and it kind of defied the genre, because it's literary fiction, but it reads like a crime novel and you just cannot put it down. And of course, there's now a second one.
Yeah.
The second cut.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Love Louise Welsh.
Yes.
Great. What about you, Marissa? Have you found time to read anything, and anything you want to shout about at the moment?
I've read and enjoyed The Last Dance by Mark Billingham, his new series. It's fantastic, and it's set in Blackpool. And it's just, it's so much fun. It's just absolutely fantastic.
It's much funnier than his other stuff. Oh, it's much lighter, you know, in tone, isn't it?
Yeah, other books. Yeah. But it's the synopsis is the, you know, the two people in adjoining rooms in a Blackpool hotel being shot in the head, and were they, you know, victims of a hitman. You just think it's so bonkers and it works so well. It's so fantastic. I've also been reading Alan Parks' To Die in June. Mm-hmm. His Harry McCoy series are just fantastic. It's 1970s Glasgow. And I was a child in 1970s Glasgow, and it just seems so kind of authentic. It's absolutely fantastic. And also in kind of historical fiction, I read earlier this year a book called Rose Nicholson by Andrew Gregg.
Okay.
And it's set in the 1570s in Scotland, which was not a great place to be. And it's about a young man who goes to St Andrews to study and meets up with Rose Nicholson, who is basically a fisherwoman. Her brother's a philosopher, and she has opinions of her own, which at that time means that you're suspect, and she's almost burned as a witch. Mm. So it's like, but what I really love about it is it's so beautifully written. It's so atmospheric. It kind of captures the paranoia of the time. It's just absolutely brilliant. Fantastic. Oh, wow.
Fantastic. What a list.
Yes, great.
I've written them down. thank you for all those recommendations.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And it's time for another, because it's time for The Book Off, where each of you gets 3 minutes uninterrupted, if you wish to use your 3 minutes, to tell us about a book you love that you think everyone listening and me should read. And this could be anything. It can be fiction, can be non-fiction, can be new, can be old, it can be a children's book, it can be poetry. We've had some real surprises on Book Off over the last few years. And before we find out what books you're putting forward, we've got to do a little bit of Book Off admin. We always say whoever's travelled the furthest gets to decide if they go first or second. Now, technically, through the wires, Marissa has travelled the furthest.
Yeah,
so, Marissa, would you like to go first or would you like to go second?
I think I'll go second, please.
Okay, see, she's putting you on first. Wants to see what you're made of. Which means, Heidi, you get to choose whether you're going to be rung out with the bell or honked at with the horn at your 3 minutes. Which one would you prefer?
Definitely honked out by the horn.
You've got to be
horn.
Honked. Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Definitely.
That means you're going to get the bell, Marissa. So I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock and you're going first, Heidi. And before we set it, tell us the book you're putting forward, please.
I am putting forward The Elements of Style by Strunk and White. William Strunk and E.B. White.
All right, well, it's 3 minutes on the clock. Over to you to tell us about The Elements of Style.
Okay, so I've picked this book because I love it and I recommend it to absolutely everyone who is writing, particularly people like me who is writing in English as a second language. English is huge, it's rich in words, but it's also incredibly complex. It's inconsistent, it's confusing, it's full of traps. And this book, this really, really tiny book, offers the hope that it can be somehow known, that the rules can be known and that it can be controlled. It's an illusion, of course. And I think I've spent the rest of my life trying to learn English. But I love this book. It's based on work that's more than 100 years old. It was a professor at Cornell who basically created his own textbook for his students in English, a professor. He was William Strunk Jr., by the way. It was 1919. And he met a student who was called White. And White later, many, many years later, produced this book that he edited and then he added to it. And it's been published quite a few times. I just like to read just a simple thing, which I think explains everything. So he calls it the little book, by the way. Strunk always referred to it as a little book. And he says, a sentence should contain no unnecessary words, a paragraph, no unnecessary sentences, for the same reason that a drawing should have no unnecessary lines and a machine, no unnecessary parts. And then I paraphrase slightly, this requires that every word tell, which I think is a great advice. It sounds easier than it actually is, because it's hard to write briefly, as we know. And basically his mantra is omit needless words. So I try and practice this, and also hoping that one day I can attain the level of confidence. Because what I love about William Strunk is he's incredibly opinionated. So he says things are fact when in fact they're just a matter of his opinion. So those words he doesn't like. He doesn't like the word not. He says it's much more powerful to frame even negative sentiments positively, which is something I think about every time I use the word not. And also he's incredibly self-confident. I can see him strutting around in front of his desk, in front of the students, just saying, this is how it is. And I love that. I love that kind of certainty, because for me, it sort of belies the tricky nature of English, which for some reason I chose to write in rather than my native Danish. So I really recommend it to everyone, and I think you're about to honk me out.
Very good. Oh, well done. You were bringing it to such a lovely close already anyway. So I think you were bang on there. Gosh, that's an incredible sounding, but I don't know where to start with that. Have a rest, have a breather. We're going to come back and talk about The Elements of Style, because that is like no book I've ever heard of. Very much looking forward to talking to you more about it. But it's over to Marissa now, because we're putting 3 minutes back on the clock for you. And before we start it, Marissa, tell us the book you're putting forward, please.
I'm putting forward Mayflies by Andrew O'Hagan.
All right, I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock then, Marissa. It's over to you to tell us about Mayflies.
I read Mayflies at the end of last year, and I was a bit of a reluctant reader because I had seen it described as a kind of exploration of male friendship. And I thought I wasn't sure that was going to be for me. But I think that's underselling it enormously. It's an absolutely phenomenal book. Split into two parts, it deals with a group of working class friends from Ayrshire in 1986, who have not long left school, aren't sure what they're going to do with themselves, but they have that kind of late teenage obsession with music, and they all go for this wild weekend in Manchester. And this is the first half of the book, and it's just full of wonderful observations about working class life and boys of that time growing up in Thatcher's Britain, maybe having limited expectations of their life. It's about the joy of youth. It's about fascination with music and lists. And it's all very relatable and also written, so beautifully written, so well observed and funny, amusing, warm, just fantastic. And then the second half of the book is decades later, when they've all grown up, they're all in their 40s, and the main character, who is now a writer, is contacted by his teenage friend who has been given some bad news. He has a life-threatening illness, and they go through this journey together at the end of their life, or at the end of Tully's life, and it deals with regrets, and it's how they deal with the death of this really significant person in their life, and it explores the options at the end of life about whether we should have a choice about how we end things. It's an absolutely wonderful book. It's emotional, it's sad, it's funny, it's about big things in life, it's about youth, it's about death. It's just phenomenal. And wow, I think everyone should read it.
Wow. And you didn't need the full three minutes, just done it in 2.5 there, Marissa. That's fantastic. Wow, what a pitch as well. Goodness me. Do you know that book?
I know Andrew Hagen because he taught me on one of my very first writing courses in the UK, together with Jeff Dyer, which was like a match made in heaven.
Oh my gosh, yeah, wow.
And I agree, he's an incredibly, he's warm, funny writer, and his sort of, his voice is incredibly distinct. Yeah, so I think that's a really great recommendation. Yeah. And one I haven't yet managed to read, but it's on my list. So,
well, we'll come back and talk about it in a minute, Marissa. Heidi, to come back to the elements of style. Right, so I didn't know anything about this book before you said you were doing it. I was like very much open to just being surprised. And you said in your pitch, and one of the things you said was, it's rich and complex and inconsistent and confusing. And I was like, this is amazing that you're talking about this. You'd recommend it to anyone who's writing in a different language. And actually, that made me think, why did you decide to write in English? Do you know?
I don't know. And in many ways, my life might have been simpler if I...
Because it's amazing that you do, by the way.
But I think it's because, you know, writing ultimately is talking to somebody. It's telling somebody a story. And my somebodies are here, you know, my loved ones, my partner, my children. Yeah. And so I think I just had this desire to take them to Copenhagen, that the book was then translated into Danish by someone else and has come out there and has been quite popular there. Was a real surprise to me because I thought they knew everything there was to know, but it seems to have sort of struck a little bit of a chord even with them. So
yeah, which is great.
But I think it's just one of those things that it's like trying to remember your PIN number. It's best if it's just in your fingers. And for me, the choice is just something that, you know, I've never written anything good in terms of fiction in Danish. And also, I was talking about the language when I said it was confusing and inconsistent.
The book
is everything but confusing.
You were talking about the language.
That's clear.
Because it's so concise as well, isn't it?
It's incredibly concise. It's under 100 pages. And it was even smaller when it was a textbook because that was the whole point, you know, that he wanted to make it simple. But also, I think he was, as I think White says in the foreword, he was thinking of the reader because he felt that readers are living in this kind of murky world. They're trying desperately to understand what we writers are trying to tell them. Why do they have to have such a hard time? That was his... Mm. Sort of thing. Let's help the reader.
Yeah.
Let's cut to the chase. And he hated any kind of embroidery, any kind of, you know, adjectives unnecessary. Just get rid of them. Just tell us what happened. And I do love that. I think it's slightly unattainable. And as I say, I think it's an illusion. But I love that kind of, you know, certainty. I'm right about that.
I love the self-confidence and assurance of it, as you said, and that Strunk is so opinionated and sort of says things that he just believes are true, even if it's just his own opinion. I love that about
it. I think he doesn't like the word forceful. He believes it should be forcible or something like that. Now I can't even remember, but it's little things like that. And you think, OK, I'm going to park that over here, but I'm going to take the bit about framing negative things positively because I think that is true, actually.
Yeah.
And it looks better on the page.
He doesn't like the word not.
He does not like the word not. He thinks it rarely comes into its own.
I've got a little saying that I picked up many years ago, which is don't say why, say why not.
Yeah. Love that.
I try and live a bit by that.
Incidentally, he would have loved that too.
He would have,
because he loved a little kind of pithy phrase. Yeah.
It's that sort of phrase that would appear in that book, the little book.
Exactly.
Fascinating. Had never heard of it. And I love that it's obviously helped you as a writer as well and been so important. So thank you for putting that on our radar. And Marissa, I mean, gosh, what an amazing novel Mayflies is. And I love that you started out saying that you were a reluctant reader of it, because I get that. I think sometimes we can read blurbs, can't we? Or we can just sort of get, or even some people just look at a cover and they think that's not for me. And a book can be undersold in a blurb, or it can be not really about what it actually is about or the depth of it. And so I'm really glad that you sort of pushed on with it. And you said it's a phenomenal book, and I would agree. Obviously, as a huge music fan, and as one of those people who has been obsessed with music since they were like nine, and having talked to your husband extensively about music, Marissa, yes, you know, I relate to the characters. And it's so good. It's so clever that it's split in these two halves, because, you know, sometimes writers can do that, can't they? And you think, oh, that's quite forced. That's sort of like a nice, they've just sliced down the middle and told one and then told the other. Whereas that's not the case for this book.
No, it's, I'm reluctant to use the word organic, but that's kind of how
you can
it
use
feels.
It.
It's kind of how it feels. It's because I think when you, again, if you're a kind of middle-aged person looking back at your youth, you know, it's they're kind of really pivotal times, aren't they? Youth and midlife, and the how you behave in midlife, how is it related to how you were in youth? I don't know. It's just it deals with so many kind of big concepts, but it's a very easy read. You know, it's not difficult. It's not, as Heidi was saying, he's not making it hard for the reader. It's really easy to read. It's beautifully written. It's so compelling, and there's lots of comedy and tragedy. And I love the thing about music when you're in your teens, because I'm probably not quite as keen on it, on music as Chris is, but the music of the 1980s when I was a teenager is the music that still speaks to me now. There are songs that I never tired of listening to, and I think that's probably the same for most people.
So much so.
Is Chris in the fun loving crime writers band, or
yes, he is a frustrated musician, I think. Yeah.
I don't know if anybody has the opportunity to see those guys live at Bloody Scotland or something like that. It's really, really entertaining.
Oh,
super entertaining.
Yes, and just to finish on that pitch, it's so interesting you brought this book up, and there's that whole sort of exploring should we have choice at the end of our lives, and talking about the end and knowing it's coming, as Tully does, you know, sooner than it should, because I just think that's it's something that can be explored in fiction, but it's also something that I think is so important that people are talking about in real life as well. I think it's something, especially in this country, I don't think we do it well. I remember hearing Carrie Ad Lloyd, who put a book out earlier this year, You Are Not Alone, and she's the host of Griefcast. And this book, You Are Not Alone, has sort of got lots of, I guess, advice that she's picked up. So it's not hers, but it's through conversations she had with people about grief. And what came out of that was, or one of the main messages was, talk about it. You know, talk about this thing we don't want to talk about. And that's what this book sort of does, albeit fiction. But it's really well observed, as you said, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of grief counsellors would say that we are very reluctant to talk about death. I think I'm probably more comfortable talking about it because I have a medical background. But I certainly know that Chris isn't keen on talking about end-of-life planning. And a lot of people think it's morbid to talk about it.
I don't.
But I think it's probably... I don't think so either, and I think it's probably healthy.
Honestly, and coming back to the music thing, you're going to laugh. I know you're going to laugh at me, but I've written down my funeral songs, right, on my phone. I've written them down because the thought of getting knocked over by a bus tomorrow and someone picking the wrong tunes or just picking something, I'm like, no, can't abide that. Thank you.
What's the key moment, the coffin slides
in
behind?
I haven't actually ordered them. Oh, that's good. That is a good question. I'll have to think about the order.
More organisation is required there.
Thank you, Heidi. No, I've just sort of splurged them down, but actually you're right. I need to actually think carefully about the plotting of them. Anyway, enough about my funeral songs. but they're on my phone if anyone needs them. I absolutely loved both of these pictures. Two incredibly different books as well. And I loved your passion for both of them. Do you know what? I think I'm going to take the Andrea Hagen. I think I'm going to take Mayflies because he taught you.
He did. So that makes... probably even I would, because this is a different class of book. I would say I still go for the fiction experience every time.
Also, you haven't read this one, Heidi. So this exactly. I'm sort of choosing it in a way that
for
you
both
can
of us.
Yes for yeah. both of us exactly.
I approve.
Yeah. Well done, Marissa. You took the crown. Yeah. I can't actually remember if Chris took the book off Crown or not when he was on. I think he was against Mick Herron. I'm not sure who won. I'd have to listen back.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't remember either, although I do remember the book that he recommended.
Do you? Yeah. That's cool.
So McCarran is amazing. Another one I would, recommend so much. Slow Horses.
Yeah.
Just so wonderful. The characters, the humour. I just recommend to anyone, just get stuck into McCarran's
books. He's so great.
Books.
He's so great. I love those books. And I do remember, I think, if I remember correctly, although I haven't got as good a memory as you, Marissa, for remembering the book he chose, but we were having a lovely chat, and then I said, right, now it's time for the book off, and both of them went into competitive mode. Both of them stepped up. They were like, right, okay, here we go, roll the sleeves up. You know, they really... choose my book. Thank you both for those fabulous recommendations and pictures. And here's two more for you. The Girl in the Photo by Heidi Amsick. It's out now. It's published by Muswell Press. And Voices of the Dead by Ambrose Parry is also out now, published by Canongate. Thank you both for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to spend this time with you.
Thank you very much. It's been great. Thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.